We don't have enough left. We don't have enough lawyers left. All right. We're going to go on to case 133350, Outland Renewable Energy LLC versus Gamesa, or Gamesa Technical Corporation. And Mr. Pierce? Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Jack Pierce, and I'm appearing on behalf of the appellants. The primary question for this Court, there is a secondary question, but the primary question for this Court is whether the District Court properly exercised supplemental jurisdiction when it dismissed those counterclaims between the third-party plaintiff and defendants as it relates to what has been affectionately called the other state law claims.
You know, I just want to start you out this way, if it's okay with you. Has your client considered the possible consequences if we were to agree with your contention that the District Court lacked subject matter jurisdiction over the counterclaim that Outland itself filed? Because what you're essentially contending is that the federal claims were frivolous and that the state tort and contract claims had no sufficient factual nexus with the rest of the litigation, which of course has led me to wonder what Outland's vice president and general counsel was thinking when he signed the original counterclaim. If we granted your request to remand with directions to dismiss the counterclaim for lack of jurisdiction, could we not then expect that Gamesa would file a motion seeking compensation for the fees that it has spent litigating that counterclaim, you know, pursuant to Rule 11 or Section 1927? Or even that Judge Koukouras might entertain that possibility sua sponte.
Well, as the Court knows, I'm sort of the player to be named later as it relates to this file. I have spoken with the client. And the fact that a counterclaim is raised that does not have subject matter jurisdiction, I don't think necessarily rises to the level in and
no,
of itself.
No. You have argued to us, however, that your client's federal antitrust claims are so frivolous as to fail even to invoke federal jurisdiction. Why isn't that a confession of a Rule 11 violation?
Not frivolous in that the sense that they were failed to invoke federal jurisdiction. Frivolous in the sense that the District Court ruled on the motion to dismiss or judgment on the pleading that the facts asserted in the complaint were insufficient to raise even the federal claim.
No, you've got that backwards. The district judge dismissed for failure to state a claim. You're arguing not only did they fail to state a claim, they were utterly frivolous. Query whether it's useful to distinguish between frivolous and utterly frivolous for these purposes. But I've never seen this before, where the party who filed the claims is telling us there was absolutely nothing to this, and not even sufficient to facially invoke the jurisdiction of the court.
With all due respect, I think that is a mischaracterization of the argument in the sense that there is no concession made at the district court, no concession made in the briefing to this court, that the claims that were asserted were frivolous or utterly frivolous. What the district court determined was that the claims were fatally flawed for a variety of reasons. And when the appellants below made their motion to amend, the district court made the same conclusion. But the mere fact that the district court said that they were fatally flawed, and then below the appellants brought a motion to have the other state law claims dismissed, the argument made then and made here is that based on the district court's determination as to the nature of the claims that were asserted to it, that the district court was then required to perform an examination as to whether or not it could retain supplemental jurisdiction under Section 1367.
Okay, we'll get to that point, but what did I miss in your brief? As a result, the federal claims were not of sufficient substance to support supplemental jurisdiction.
And that's, in the brief, that was the argument based on the district court's decision.
Are you abandoning your brief?
No, I am not abandoning my brief, Your Honor, the appellant's brief. What I am stating is that the argument set forth in the brief, perhaps inartfully drafted, is that based on the district court's decision with respect to what it thought of those federal claims that were asserted in the complaint and in the amended complaint, that the district court then should have exercised its discretion and abandoned supplemental jurisdiction.
Wait, you're saying it's all in the district judge's mind? This is preposterous. Either the claims are sufficiently substantial to invoke jurisdiction or they're not.
On their face, the claims were sufficient to invoke federal subject matter jurisdiction.
Yes.
And then,
okay.
And then,
so, okay, we're past that point in your brief. Now, with respect to your argument that the district judge had an obligation to evaluate whether to exercise his discretion to under 1367 to exercise supplemental jurisdiction, the Supreme Court and we have said several times that is not a question of subject matter jurisdiction. It's discretionary, it's waivable, and you have to ask for it. I'm referring to Mayor of City of Philadelphia against Educational Equality League and Myers against County of Lake, Indiana from our court. Could you address that?
The appellant below did ask. After the motion to amend was denied, the appellant...
In your Rule 59 motion or before that?
The Rule 59 motion. Before
you've
that,
already
no,
lost at that point.
Correct.
Okay.
And it was at that point in time in which the appellant sought dismissal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
Heads, I win. Tails, I get to walk away. Right?
In essence, yes, Your Honor.
That's ridiculous.
But I don't necessarily believe so, in the sense that upon the dismissal of the federal claims, it is not as if the federal district court has no obligation whatsoever to determine whether or not it can exercise jurisdiction.
If this is a jurisdiction you asked it to exercise,
and now,
and then after you lose, you say, we don't want it anymore. Why is this not sanctionable?
We're saying that the district court under Rothman should have said, or should have examined, when it dismissed.
If you had asked it to.
Yes. You never asked Judge Kukor.
Not until until your Rule 59 motion, which is way too late.
I mean, you could have asked him in advance to consider relinquishing the state claims if he granted judgment on the pleadings as to the federal claims.
These are tactics that utterly waste everybody's time. Again, it's the heads I win, tails I get to walk away. And that's not the way we do things.
I understand the court's concern, Your Honor.
I was wondering why there was a 5-month delay before seeking leave to amend the counterclaim. I mean, that delay alone might be enough to justify Judge Kokoris's decision to deny the motion.
There were the major thrust of the litigation below dealt with a resolution of the plaintiff's claims. The matter started out as a personal injury matter, and the majority of the time spent below dealt with that.
Wasn't there a big preliminary injunction fight about termination of your relationship?
There was a preliminary injunction fight. There were hearings that were reset for mediation. The parties in June, I believe mediation was scheduled in June of 2012. It's docket 268. There was a hearing that was reset for the parties to mediate. There was a lengthy preliminary injunction hearing, I believe in January of 2012, if my memory serves. And then it was in September of 2012 in which the motion for judgment on the pleadings was granted. And then it was March 2013 in which the motion to amend was brought before the district court.
Could we go back for a second? In your Rule 59 motion, I know you raised the supplemental jurisdiction question generally, but where did you ask the district judge to exercise his discretion?
I don't...
You were arguing that they were not part of the same common nucleus of operative facts.
Same part of...
But that's a different issue than asking the judge simply to exercise jurisdiction, or exercise discretion, rather, not to exercise jurisdiction that he could have had.
I don't believe that the pleadings in connection with the Rule 59 motion said, please exercise your discretion. I think what it said was alter or amend the judgment such that to for a ruling that the court did not have supplemental jurisdiction over the other
for a different argument. Reason than you're arguing here, or an additional reason. I mean, my point is that I don't think this, the argument you're making here, well, the district judge has to exercise jurisdiction. If he doesn't exercise jurisdiction, doesn't explain his decision, that's an abuse of discretion, you got to send this back, and that's all new here, right?
That part of it is.
Yes.
The issue with respect to whether or not the facts set forth in the counterclaim are part of this are properly subject to supplemental jurisdiction for whatever claim they're based upon was argued in the Rule 59 motion.
Which is a different question, but it was argued, you're right.
It was argued. And with respect to that question, the other state law claims are not based on the same set of operative facts.
As the federal antitrust claims?
Correct.
They're all about this campaign to try to drive you guys out of business, right?
No, the state law claims involve tortious interference with contract.
And I understand what they are. I'm talking about the common nucleus of operative facts.
The common nucleus of operative facts with respect to the state law claims was the appellee contacting a third party in an event to prohibit that third party from entering into a relationship with the appellant in which they would obtain a percentage interest.
And to drive you all out of business,
so,
right?
Yeah, aren't
all
the,
part of the same campaign.
Aren't the tortious...
You're the one who put these claims together, for crying out loud.
The appellant did put the claims together, yes, Your Honor.
And now you're telling us this was utterly baseless.
I don't think the other state law claims are utterly baseless, no, Your Honor.
No, the linkage, filing them in federal court. That's what you're telling us now.
What I am arguing to the court is that the fact that the other state law claims, in my opinion, do not come from the same operative facts as the tying claim and the unfair competition claim under federal law.
Look, here's what this certainly looks like. It looks like having lost on the other state claims in federal court, your new goal is to relitigate these same claims in Minnesota court. And to get there, you're arguing that we should disregard all these years of litigation on these claims that has already occurred in federal court and give you a do-over without consequences. And that is not correct.
The goal is the opportunity to litigate the claims because there wasn't much in the way of litigation below.
There was, and you lost. You can argue the merits, but by trying to get out of federal court in Illinois where you filed these claims, all you are doing is running up costs and essentially trying to thumb your nose at the judicial system.
There's also the issue with whether or not it was proper to deny the motion to amend the complaint, which is separate and independent from the issue with respect to supplemental jurisdiction.
Well, I asked you about that delay. You know, you had that five-month delay before you even sought to amend the counterclaim.
On the merits of these claims, one of the claims you wanted to assert on the amendment had to do with indemnification, right?
Yes.
What indemnification claim do you contend was not settled between your client and Gamesa?
The OSHA claim.
Okay. Have you pointed us, do we have language in the relevant settlement discussion in our record?
There isn't. There are, I believe, two orders. Yes. The answer is yes. I believe there are two orders from the district court that deal with the settlements between the various parties, and it reserves the business law claims and the indemnification claim. I think it's paragraph 3. I don't remember that. I don't have the docket number memorized as to which part of that order. But yes, to answer the court's question.
Well, I know the district judge didn't dismiss the indemnification claims originally, and then there was a settlement, right?
There was a settlement involving the plaintiff and other
parties.
Could
you point it? Do we have the position you're taking here is an improbable one. It's not impossible, but it's improbable. Improbable in that it would suggest that the opposing party settled these claims without a complete settlement of indemnification claims. Can you point us to operative language in the settlement agreement that saves your OSHA indemnification claims?
I don't believe the settlement agreement is part of the record, Your Honor, so no, I cannot. I believe what's on the record is...
Did you put it in front of the district court?
I was not
traveling. Did your counsel, I don't care how late you came into this, you're responsible for this appeal at this point.
I'm unaware if it was put before the district court judge.
Okay. You want to save what little time you have?
I'll save what time I have left, Your Honor. Thank you.
Ms. Nicobin.
Good morning. May it please the court?
Good morning.
Mr. Pierce, this appeal, as your honors have very aptly ascertained, is just a standard forum shopping exercise. And Outland has attempted to package it as a law school civil procedure quagmire. It's not. 28 U.S.C. Section 1367 provides for supplemental jurisdiction to the broadest extent of the court's Article III power. As long as the state law claims have arise from the same case or controversy, supplemental jurisdiction is proper.
Do you have a sense of the amount of fees GAMHSA has incurred in litigating Outland's counterclaim?
I do, Your Honor.
Want to share it?
More than $100,000.
Could you answer the question about this indemnification claim?
Yes. The indemnification claim that Outland asserted in its counterclaim doesn't specifically say OSHA fines. It says we're seeking indemnification for McCoy's claims against us. To the extent we're found liable, we're seeking indemnification.
This is in the amended, the proposed amended counterclaim.
Okay. Yes.
And do we have the relevant language of your settlement of the indemnification claims available to us?
The good faith order, the order that approved the settlement as a good faith settlement, contains a specific carve out for Outland's commercial counterclaims. They're called commercial counterclaims.
That's all that survived.
That's all that survived. And, Your Honor, I negotiated that. And if I had even an inkling that they were attempting to put those OSHA fines in under an indemnification claim, it wouldn't have gone forward.
On the claim for tortious interference, could you talk about why this requires a termination of the relationship as opposed to a change in the favorability of the terms of that relationship?
Voiles is the case that we would rely upon. The fact that GAMHSA didn't even know that there was an amended acquisition agreement is one of the reasons Judge Koukouras denied that claim going forward. They didn't even allege knowledge of that amended agreement. And then in the end...
Did you say Voiles?
Voiles.
Voiles, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Do you need the citation? So it's 196 Illinois 2nd, 288, sets forth four requirements for tortious interference, including termination.
Yeah.
The Illinois courts have used some looser language from time to time, defeat and so on, but Voiles tells us breach or termination.
Breach, right? Or termination, breach or termination under the Voiles test, yes, Your Honor. Okay. And in this case, Duke did end up acquiring Outland. We don't know exactly for how much. There were different allegations in the complaints about, you know, the original offer was $15 million, and it was an asset purchase in the end, but we don't know how much it was. But really, Judge Koukouras refused to allow those claims to go forward, not just on the idea that it wasn't an ultimate termination, but also because they didn't allege we had knowledge of this amended agreement. And Gamesa was justified in its actions. Gamesa did two things according to the complaint. We sent a default letter to Outland based upon the McCoy accident, a default letter under the contract. We didn't send it to Duke. There's no allegation we sent it to Duke. There was an allegation we sent it to Outland. And that we called Duke and we said, you know, guys, we really would rather that you continue with Gamesa as your O&M providers. We're a competitor. They allege it all over the place that our entire motivation between paragraphs 44 and 134 of the complaint, Gamesa's motivation for all their actions were because we were trying to put them out of business and we were going to compete with them. So we called Duke and we said, hey, we'd rather provide your O&M services. And Duke said, you know, maybe that would be a good thing. But they ended up going forward with Outland anyway. So we were justified in those activities. As to the prima facie tort claim in the amended complaint, Illinois has never recognized such a claim. Pennsylvania has never recognized such a claim. And Minnesota, the law that they hope to invoke here, has never recognized such a claim. And just on the issue of application of Minnesota law, we've talked a little bit about waiver of the subject matter jurisdiction argument, but Judge Koukouras also found that Outland had waived their ability to request application of Minnesota law because, among other things, one of the very first motions that we made on behalf of Gamesa was to dismiss the counterclaims on the basis of improper venue. The contract between Outland and Gamesa required venue in Pennsylvania and the application of Pennsylvania law. Outland argued Illinois law applied and the Construction Act voided any choice of law provision in the contract. And Judge Koukouras agreed, and he denied our motion. Our next motion was a motion for judgment on the pleadings. But in the meantime, we had a five-day preliminary injunction hearing in which Illinois law applied. So in the end, they waived the application of Minnesota law. And then we talked about the indemnification claim. So, Your Honors, we would request respectfully that this court affirm Judge Koukouras's order and dismiss this case finally after more than $100,000 in fees. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time?
2 minutes.
I just want to speak briefly on the two state law claims, the tortious interference with contract claim and the tortious interference with the respective business.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. I
want to speak just briefly on the tortious interference with contract claim and the district court's decision that the fact that there wasn't knowledge of an amendment to a contract makes it difficult to breach the overall contract. Well, an amendment to a contract is just a change in the original contract itself. And so,
what was the amendment here?
The amendment was to add an institutional investor as another party to the agreement and to acquire a larger percentage.
From 25% to
100%.
That's a pretty big change, isn't it?
It is a very big change.
As opposed to an extension on a deadline or something like that?
True. But I do not believe that an amendment to an agreement, the distinction with respect to knowledge is based on the substantialness or lack thereof of the amendment to the contract.
Why
the
not?
Overall, because the overall tenor of this contract was that Duke was going to be acquiring a portion. That was the subject matter, a portion. The fact that that portion went from 25 to 100 and added an additional investor does not change the fact that the contract involved the sale of a percentage at 1.25 and at 1.100 of the interest of Outland to Duke. with respect to the tortious interference with a prospective business relationship, it's the expectancy. It's the change. To say that there must be a total defeating of the prospective business relationship from $100 to zero would reward those entities who interfere with the contract.
Right. That's an interesting argument. How does it fit with the Supreme Court, Illinois Supreme Court's language in Voiles?
Well, in Voiles, that talks about the tortious interference with contract
and
business relationship. And yes, it says termination or breach of the expectancy or the contract. Is it a breach of an expectancy? If you expect X, may I see the red light on, may I finish the answer to the court's question?
Of course.
If the expectancy is X, and as a result of tortious conduct, the expectancy morphs into X minus Y, is that a breach in the expectancy? Have you received less than what you would have otherwise expected to receive? And that's the tortious interference with a prospective business relationship. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you to one and all, and the case will be taken under advisement.